Tango Tango Papa 1808, December 26, 2013.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you once again from home. I am still on vacation. The bulk of the vacation is gone. It zipped right past. And so I've got a few days to go yet. Back to work on the 30th, so I've got the 26, 27, 28, and 29. So I got 4 days basically left, and then back to work on Monday. I think Monday's the 30th. So I have Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and then back to work Monday. So it's, I don't know, it's like 1:12 a.m. It's actually the 26th, but it's 1:12 a.m. So it's really, I think of it as sort of really late Wednesday night. So in any case, I've been not podcasting very much, obviously. Kind of hanging out with family, parents. I've done that for the past couple of years anyway. Spent my entire vacation hanging out with my parents as much as possible. And family dinners, and there've been several family dinners and so on and so forth, and always enjoy it, as I say, it's the days are sort of rapidly moving past, as they always do. So now, when I first got home, it was there was snow on the ground, and of course it was cold, and then it kind of warmed up and all of the snow melted, and then now it's kind of colder again. We had a little dusting of snow, but that melted pretty quick. I think that was either, maybe it was the day before yesterday, there was just a little bit, you could see where it accumulated a little bit on some surfaces. And then that kind of melted, and so there's no, the only snow that remains, there's still some big piles in certain parking lots. I saw some today, and that's going to be hanging around for a while. We're supposed to get up to possibly 60 degrees, I think they said Saturday, and then it's going to turn cold again. But, don't know if, if there's going to be any more snow anytime soon, but so it may be colder. It's probably going to be colder again whenever I go back to work on Monday. So, but that's not going to stop me from going back to work. Gotta work. So, what I have, I've got another comment from Joel. He's got a comment, and he's got a couple of different, I've already listened to it, and he's got a couple of different topics in it that I'm sure I'm probably going to do a stop-start on it and kind of respond to it. And I've also, before I do that, I've got an article and it's talking about trauma. This is from AP. It's an AP story. Making Raped Teens Relive Trauma Works, study says. It almost sounds sadistic, making rape victims as young as 13 relive their harrowing assault over and over again. But a new study shows it works surprisingly well at eliminating their psychological distress. The results are the first evidence that the same kind of exposure therapy, that's what they're calling it, exposure therapy, that helps combat veterans haunted by flashbacks and nightmares also works for traumatized sexually abused teens with similar symptoms, the study authors and others experts said. After exposure therapy, 83% no longer had a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. They fared much better than girls who got only supportive counseling. 54% in the group no longer had PTSD after the treatment. Girls who got exposure therapy also had much better scores on measures of depression and daily functioning than girls who got conventional counseling. It's common to think that offering just comforting words and encouraging traumatized youngsters to forget their ordeals is protecting them, but that's not doing them any favors, said University of Pennsylvania psychologist Edna Foa, F-O-A, the lead author. She said that approach can be harmful because it lets symptoms fester. Foa developed a two-part treatment known as prolonged exposure therapy and has studied its use in treating post-traumatic stress disorder. It involves having patients repeatedly tell their awful stories and then visit safe places that remind them of the trauma, or take part in safe activities they'd avoided because of painful reminders. Many are actually relieved that somebody wants to hear their story, Foa said. The Veterans Affairs Health System uses the treatment for vets with PTSD. Foa's previous research has shown that this approach works for adult rape victims and is used in some rape crisis centers. Her new study was published Tuesday in the Journal of American Medical Association. 61 girls aged 13 to 18 were recruited at a rape crisis center in Philadelphia. They had been raped or sexually abused, sometimes repeatedly, often by a relative. All had been diagnosed with PTSD. The researchers provided 4 days of prolonged exposure training for counselors at the center, with 2 days of supportive counseling training. The teens were randomly assigned to 14 weeks of counseling or prolonged exposure therapy from the counselors. Sessions lasted an hour or 90 minutes. At first, most were very upset talking about what had happened, but by telling and retelling their trauma, they get a new perspective of what happened, Foa said. They get used to thinking and talking about the memory and realizing that it was in the past and that it's not in the present anymore. Eventually, the story becomes remote and they get closure, she said. Benefits of the prolonged exposure therapy lasted throughout a 1-year follow-up. A JAMA editorial said many therapists are reluctant to try the treatment with kids because of concerns that it might worsen symptoms, but that the study should raise awareness of the benefits. The study should allay therapists' concerns about any potential harmful effects of exposure, said editorial author Sean Perrin, a psychologist at Lund University in Sweden and a specialist in PTSD treatment in kids. The distress that comes with reliving the trauma usually dissipates within a few sessions and is essential to recovery, he said. And so, I think this is very valid, and I can kind of tell you what is going on. If you have a trauma, and the tendency is to bury the trauma, and you think you're doing someone a favor by, you know, telling them, well, it's okay, you know, forget that it ever happened or whatever. And that's a mistake. You want to expose it as much as possible. And you'd think, well, they're reliving it. And, you know, and I would say this, that if they're retelling the story over and over, and different people are listening and what have you, but they're deliberately sort of retelling the story, at some point they have to become conscious of the fact that that they're resenting, you know, they resent the person that raped them, and then they, you know, all of the things that were present in the rape, all of those things that are present sort of trigger the memories again and sort of re-trigger the resentment. The resentment kind of gets re-energized. And by retelling it, I think what's happening, if they're getting to retell the story over and over again and sort of relive it, but you know, in this case, they're telling somebody, they're not keeping it to themselves. It, you know, you're sort of exposing it to the light of day in a sense. And at some point, it's just a, it just becomes a sort of a, just a memory, you know, and they kind of realize that it's just a memory. You know, it's interesting, you know, we really, when it comes right down to it, we really don't know how the brain works. You know, they're making all kinds of inroads, you know, and they're into different chemical reactions that happen in the brain, and they're trying to figure out how memory works, and they've made some progress with that. But when it comes right down to it, the brain is still a huge mystery, how it works, so on and so forth. So, but I think that, you know, it does make sense that, you know, from my perspective, getting rid, you know, kind of getting the resentment out in the open, getting that out in the open by retelling the story and continually, you know, not just reliving it, keeping it to yourself, but actually telling the story, there's a great deal of validity to that. And, you know, one of the reasons, you know, from a physical standpoint might be that, you know, they say that, you know, from a chemical standpoint, when you remember a memory, you actually, the memory can end up becoming altered because of the way the chemistry works. The memory itself sort of becomes altered over time. And, you know, that's probably why some of the details can become exaggerated or, you know, memories, you know, you don't remember exactly the order that things happened in, or, you know, the memories themselves become altered, you know, when you actually remember them. And when you're telling the story, you know, and you're telling it to someone that's actually listening to you, and you have to keep doing it over and over again, the memory is going to sort of lose, at some point, you can't just keep the resentment going. But, you know, resentment is, it's a funny little thing. Whatever it is, I can't tell you what it is. The best thing I can do is, the best description I can come up with is, you know, you're sort of playing God in your mind as if you were God and you could just strike that person dead. You know, and you somehow think that that little tingle or that little surge of resentment, whatever it is a protection. Of course, it's exactly the opposite. You become what you resent. It gives you two wrong choices. You either go along with what you resent, or you rebel and you try to do the opposite. Either way, you're separated from who you could have been. You're separated from your original identity. And so by retelling the story over and over again, I could see how that would really have some benefit. And, you know, the person would then be able to become more and more objective over time. So that's why it works, because they're getting rid, by sort of reliving this and retelling the story over and over and going through all the gory details every time. At some point, they, you know, whether they're aware of it or not, they're sort of, you can't keep the resentment going. Resentment loves to be hidden. It does not want to be exposed to the light. It's, you know, sort of ties in, you know, if you're familiar with the vampire myth, like the vampire thing, you know, where the vampire has to stay in the dark and can't be exposed to the light, you know, sunlight and what have you. Same way, you know, I think that's where, you know, sort of the basis of the vampire story. You know, because if you hide these things, from other people and you hide them from yourself, they just continue to cause problems. So the more you can you know, kind of confess them, because that's basically what this is sort of a, it's in a sense, it's kind of a confession, getting someone to tell the story over and over again. You know, and of course, rape victims often feel guilty. Any kind of person that's been raped or traumatized in some way, they often end up feeling guilty themselves. And the reason, you know, they don't really understand it, but the reason they feel guilty is because they're inferior. Resentment is an inferior response. And then trying to hide it is adding insult to injury. So the best thing to do is to tell the story. You know, tell it to anybody that would listen. You know, and at some point, you know, it's gone. And then it's just a memory. So, but that's the mechanism behind it. Getting it out in the light of day. You know, don't hide these things. You know, get them out there. Be honest with them. Regardless of whether, you know, because a lot of times people think, well, I don't want to hurt people's feelings, or it might be awkward, or it's an awkward thing, or whatever. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but the only person that you're hurting is yourself. You know, by keeping all that stuff sort of locked away, you're just hurting yourself. You're preventing yourself from getting back to your original identity, to the source of your original identity, because resentment literally separates you from it. So I thought that was kind of an interesting article. So anyway, I've also, let's see, before I play Joel's comment, kind of been binging on Netflix quite a bit and Amazon videos, and now I've ran across it before, but I don't know why I never did start watching it. There's this I think it was on the air for about 4 years. It's a BBC series. It was called Torchwood, and so I started watching that, and I'm still in the first season. So I've been watching a bunch of those episodes in the past. I think I started watching them yesterday, and so I'm still halfway in the first season. And so that's kind of an interesting show. Nothing really profound about it. It's just sort of, you know, entertaining. Nothing. But that it's kind of interesting, sort of in the similar, you know, similar way that Fringe was sort of interesting, you know, and there have been some other series. So there's stuff out there to continue to watch, but I certainly like watching this stuff, you know, just kind of back to back and no ads. Now, I've mentioned it before. There's Netflix original series, and I've watched one of those. They've had several of them, and I've actually watched one, and it's called Lilyhammer, as in Lilyhammer, Norway. Lilyhammer is the name of it. It's produced, or you know, by Netflix in conjunction with this Norwegian television network, and so there's. You know, there was this first series, it was like 8 episodes, and then now that they just became available the other day, the latest episode. So there's a total, I think, of 16 episodes, and I don't know if the thing is going to continue now or not, but it's an interesting series. It's nothing profound, again. It's sort of a drama/comedy, and you know, it's kind of entertaining. And so I, you know, I've watched the rest of those episodes. As I say, they became available just the other day, and so I've kind of already buzzed my way through those. But those are worth watching. I will warn you that what you need to do if you're going to watch that on Netflix, turn on the captioning, because part of the dialogue is in Norwegian. So you need to be able to, if you have the captions turned on, then you'll be able to follow it. And you, and this is one of those things, this, you know, you really have to, and if you're watching something with captions, even though part of it's in English, you really need to pay attention to the captions. And so, you know, it's not one of those things that you can just kind of half watch, and you know, you got to really kind of pay attention to it and give it your attention. And it's really a well done series, so it's worth your attention. You know, and you get to, you know, Norway looks like it's a beautiful place, but it's, I don't know if I'd want to live there. It looks cold and really snowy and mountainous. But it was obviously, it's filmed in location, or at least, I don't know how much of it's filmed on, you know, a lot of it looks like it's filmed on location. Maybe the whole thing is, but it's got some beautiful scenery in it, but it's very well done. But you got to pay attention. You got to really pay attention and watch it with the captions turned on, to you know, to really get anything out of it, any kind of entertainment out of it. So that's there. And Netflix does have some other original series, and that really seems to be, I don't know, that at least, you know, if you do it that, you watch the series that are probably, you know, the ones that are produced on Netflix, or the ones that are, you know, the especially the BBC ones, they're probably going to end up resolving. You're not going to end up with, you know, so, you know, where they just kind of leave you midair because they canceled it. You know, like they, you know, there's a lot of American series where they just, we're going to cancel it, and that's the end, and maybe they end it, and maybe they don't. It's like with the Fringe, that series Fringe, they sort of allowed them, they told them, we're going to cancel this, this is going to be your last season, and, you know, with the season 5, and so they had a few more episodes, when they knew it was going to be canceled, they had a few more episodes to sort of resolve everything. And I think the series could have gone on if had it been on a, you know, like a BBC or Netflix. It could have gone on for a period of time, you know, for a period of years. And but, you know, of course, the American networks are looking for advertisers right now. And if the viewers aren't there, they don't care about the so-called long tail. They don't care about that. They want advertisers, you know, that are watching the thing as it's aired live. And so that makes it really difficult, you know, to produce a television series where you're going to have a large number of episodes, where they can kind of resolve the thing, you know, sort of an overarching story, following an overarching storyline. But so I don't mind, as I've said many times in the past, I don't mind paying the $8 a month to Netflix. It's a value. It's really valuable. I don't mind paying the $70 a year to Amazon. It's valuable. There's some real value to it because it, you know, I can watch whenever, wherever, whatever I want, and I'm not at the mercy of, you know, someone else's schedule. And, that's, you know, I'm willing to pay, but I'm not willing to pay for, satellite. I'm not willing to pay for cable. I'm not willing to basically have, you know, do an affirmative action program for crap cable channels that just have crap junk on them. And it's basically what it is. It's, you know, this bundling idea, that kind of bundling idea, It's affirmative action for crap. It really is. You know, and then they talk about a la carte. Well, streaming, you know, the like the Netflix model or the Amazon model, and I've noticed that there are some other movie studios and what have you that are adding apps to Netflix. I've noticed there's been an influx of those. And maybe at some point some of those may start to look interesting. So I'm willing to pay. I really am willing to pay, but I want value for the money, and I don't want to be sort of hijacked into paying for stuff that I don't get any value out of, or that I completely disagree with. You know, in the case of some of these news networks, or you know, some of these other networks that were getting $1 here, or $2 there, or $3 here, that you're paying through your cable bill. You know, they're getting some of your money, whether you like it or not. So the solution is to just cut them off. Because all this stuff is available, and I think at some point, you know, and broadcast isn't going to go away, but something's going to change. And I think the change, you know, the change is happening right now, but something dramatic is going to happen with broadcast. It's going to seem, at some point, it's going to seem like it happened overnight, but it's not. It's happening right now. It really is happening right now, you know, and not necessarily just broadcast, but with cable and the cable and the satellite, there's something in the process of happening. You know, it's all sort of naturally being undermined right now. And they know it. I think they realize that they're being undermined, but that doesn't stop it from happening. These market forces, You can't really stop them. Maybe, you know, sometimes people, you know, companies have been able to sort of delay them for a while. But ultimately, you know, the one thing that improves, technology, knowledge always gets better. And so therefore, technical knowledge or technology always gets better. That's, you know, the knowledge is the one thing that constantly improves. And so therefore, communications gets better. The devices get smaller, cheaper, faster, so on and so forth. And that's relentless. And so as these communications technologies improve, things are always shifting, and older models, especially now, because the knowledge is just, the rate of knowledge, the expansion of knowledge keeps, you know, it's always moving faster and faster and faster. And so things are becoming, they become undermined. You know, so, you know, cable technology itself sort of undermined broadcast to a large degree. Because broadcast had a monopoly for a number of years. And then, you know, cable and satellite came along and kind of destroyed broadcast monopoly to a certain extent. But then now we have the internet, and the internet has gotten fast enough and good enough to really start undermining the cable and the satellite business. And so it's eventually all going to be online, or, you know, most of it's going to be online. There may be, you know, broadcast. I don't think broadcast is going to go away. I don't know what's going to happen to cable. Some people, there's going to be a certain percentage of people that keep it. It's not, I don't think it's going to go completely away, but something is going to have to change. You know, and that is kind of unpredictable. That really is sort of an unpredictable element. But I can tell you one thing that is more predictable is the fact that all of these streaming services are where it's at, you know, and they're, you know, as Netflix knows, there's money to be made in streaming. So you have the right streaming service, you know, you're going to be on top of the world. You know, so, and I think it's also interesting, I discovered that, you know, there's these two big shopping channels that I used to watch. Sometimes I would watch shopping channels, QVC and then Home Shopping, the Home Shopping Network, HSN. I would actually, when I had the satellite, there were times when I would actually watch that, and it was kind of, you know, it was kind of educational and it could be entertaining. You know, I would watch, primarily I would watch the shows where they were selling different, you know, computers and other technological devices. And I would sit there and actually watch that. And they are good at selling, because good sales also educates. And so that, you know, if they're selling cameras or they're selling different technology, you know, technological devices, the people that they have on there from the companies, oftentimes they're explaining things and they're sort of educating the audience as they go along, you know, at the same time they're selling. And so I would watch those. Well, you know, those are now, QVC and HSN are now on Roku. And you can actually watch that, which I think that's pretty interesting. You know, so I don't care about, you know, the clothing, or I don't care about jewelry, but I do kind of, once in a while, I'll probably watch those now, and they're right on Roku, and they've got the live stream, and so that tells me that, you know, the people at QVC and the people at HSN are no dummies when it comes to marketing. That tells me they see the shift coming. And so if I were, you know, going to bet on something, which I wouldn't, but if I were, I would bet on streaming having, it really has a sort of a bright future. Different, you know, streaming. And, of course, there may be some changes. There may be right now that there are going to be changes. There are new companies that are coming along, and they're offering their service. You know, I'd have to actually look, but I did find one, you know, one of those movie companies has got its back catalog. I really didn't look at it very closely, but they've got an entire back catalog, and they're offering that for $8 a month, unlimited. You know, that could be quite interesting. And still, you know, you could subscribe to several different services and still be paying probably half of what you pay for your stupid cable bill. Or your stupid satellite bill. I was paying $100 a month for God knows how many years. Insanity. So these things are shifting. They're constantly shifting, and as the technology improves and the devices change, the devices improve, the communication gets better, the things become disrupted. So, anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play Joel's comment. So, here is Joel.
Hello, Tom. Hope you're having a beautiful holiday with your family. Well, I'm a walking dog now. I was just thinking about a few things, like, you know, you heard about the Amazon drones. And they're probably going to happen, maybe. I mean, it might not be for quite a while yet. A lot of regulations to figure out how do you avoid the drone getting stolen and stuff like that. It's got me more to thinking about the automate than people normally did. Like, for example, truck driving. You know, if they figure out how to make a truck drive autonomous, a person behind the wheel that can make you, you know, and tellers themselves are, you know, which have a little bit.
Okay, now let me interrupt. So what he's talking about there is the Amazon drones, And that kind of made a news story and a little bit of a splash. And I don't know. Maybe I could see that happening in certain limited instances, maybe in cities. if it's a sort of a crime, more of a crime-free neighborhood, I could see that possibly happening. But, the problem with drones, and even the problem with these, they're talking, about self-driving vehicles and there's one article I read several months ago, and it was talking about I think it was in Japan, and they had this self-driving, it was like a box truck. Didn't have a trailer, but it was a box truck. And, they had an article about it. And the problem with those things, especially if they're ferrying around valuables, is that if there's no person, if there's no human being, especially if there's no human being present, those things are prime targets to being hijacked. Because even a self-driving car, let's say you have a self-driving car and you tell the car, I want you to, drop me off at the airport and then, go home and park in the garage. Now, it'd be one thing if you're sort of in the car and you got your self-driving car and you're sitting there, kind of behind the wheel and you trust it, and so you're really a passenger because you're kind of not paying attention. The car's driving itself. That's one thing. But if the car, let's say you have a car and the car is self-driving, and obviously it's not going to be an old model, it's going to be a new model, and someone wants to steal it, and the car's driving itself, and there's no human being in the car, what are you going to do? How are you going to steal that car? You roadblock. Put something in front of it. It's going to slam the brakes on. Then it can be easily stolen, broken into and stolen. Same way with especially a self-driving truck. Now, trucks, for years, truck hijacking has periodically been a problem in, some areas. Every once in a while, you'll hear about it. You see a story about a truck getting hijacked, and that's with a driver in it, usually. Or sometimes a trailer, will be parked in a yard, and some rogue truck comes in, and they act like what they're doing, and they hook onto it, and they pull the trailer off, and nobody realizes it until it's gone. And then somebody finally, eventually, maybe, hours or days go by and they'll realize that it's missing. It's gone. Someone stole it. So with valuables involved in a public system, I don't see this automated stuff working very well. Not in the public, because it's just a sitting duck to be hijacked. It's just a sitting duck to be stolen. Stuff could be stolen easily. Whereas if you have a person in control, a person that's kind of there watching and securing things and so on and so forth, it's less likely to happen. It depends on the neighborhood and so on and so forth. But, so I don't think that this self-driving, it's going to be, the self-driving car could be really great as long as you're riding in the car, but the car driving around by itself, not so much. Same way with a self-driving truck. I don't see that happening. The only way that could happen is in a good area where you have low crime and you keep the riffraff out. then possibly it could work, you know, because it's going to be sort of a self-securing area if you have decent people living in the area. But otherwise, it's just in a city situation. I just don't see it happening. So the drone thing, I don't think that's going to happen. I think that they just threw that idea out there. Maybe they're kind of playing with the idea. I don't see that being practical at all. Self-driving cars, to a certain extent, yes, they will. You know, I think that will work as long as you're in the car, as long as you got, you know, you're an adult and you're in the car and somebody's behind the wheel. Even though they're not actually driving the car, that's going to work. That'll be fine, you know, because the person's there. But as far as the car driving around by itself, it's a sitting duck. It's just asking to be hijacked. It's asking to be stolen. Please steal me. And again, all you have to do is just put some kind of a block in the road, and it's going to slam its brakes on, and you hijack it. You steal it. Break into it, you know, hook a tow truck onto it or whatever, and, you know, it's gone. They chop it up and sell it. So, you know, while that, you know, all of this pie in the sky stuff sounds good, and it, you know, and then there's another problem with the, let's say you can somehow you can perfect self-driving trucks. A truck driver does more than just drive the truck around, you know, kind of driving it. You know, that it that does make up a lot. You know, like a lot of my time as an over-the-road truck driver, you know, I do spend a lot of time driving. However, I've got to put fuel in the truck. I've got to go to the shipper and you know, deal with people, pick in order to pick loads up. I've got to deal with the shipper, you know, kind of in person. I've got to, so that means I've got to be able to go in the building and so on and so forth. And same way on the other end with the receiver. And a self-driving truck just can't do that. You know, how's a self-driving truck gonna go up the stairs and so on and so forth? So there's all kinds of problems with that, automation, if you could somehow eliminate the hijacking problem, you still have a problem. How would the automation handle that? You know, because then you'd have to, you know, everything, you'd have to just completely revamp the warehousing system on both ends. You know, on the shipping system, shipping end, as well as the receiving end. So, I don't see that happening. Self-driving cars or a self-driving truck, you know, that's going to be fine, but you're still going to have it. I think what I'm saying is you're still going to have a driver. You know, you can automate the truck as much as possible, and if I could trust it, you know, that'd be cool with me, and I could just kind of sit there while the truck was driving. I could just kind of be there to, you know, just kind of, you know, because I'm still there with it, but I would have to still do all the other things that I do. And part of the time, I'd still have to control it. Same way with a self-driving car. You know, how's a self-driving car going to put gas in itself? And how's it going to not get hijacked? How's it not going to get stolen? So, you know, these ideas sound interesting, but it's kind of like, you know, you have a science fiction stories. You know, you have science fiction, and you got your science fiction thing. Let's say it's a series on TV or it's a movie, and they present it a certain way. You know, they kind of tell the story a certain way. But reality is always different. the reality of the thing is always, you know, it's always a different thing. And so that's the way it is in large part with these, you know, they come up with these futuristic ideas about different pieces of technology because it has to exist in the real world. You know, you have the theory, you know, and sort of present the theory in a dramatic way, but you still, you know, in the real world, you have to deal with real world issues, real world problems, real world people, and it just doesn't quite work that way. So, anyway, let's go ahead and listen to some more of Joel's comment.
More, you know, they have to have a little bit more training, you know, in regards to handling people and to handling money, banking regs and all that crap. Then, well, you know, not saying truck drivers don't have regs to follow. They do. But, you know, I guess it takes maybe take a little bit more knowledge to run a, you know, do a banking transaction, possibly, than to drive a truck. You know, I don't know all the things that you have to know as a truck driver, or I might be wrong on that. But still, what it's boiled down to is that there some banks, like, for example, my bank, my credit union that I belong to, they you'll walk into the lobby that I used to walk into for almost 20 years now, and the people, the big long counter with the people standing there is gone. And now it is a series of almost ATMs. You know, they're not, you don't have to stick a card. You just walk up and you press a button and you, eventually you basically get served and you do talk to a person still, but it's through a camera.
Okay, now let me interrupt. I've never, see, now my local bank, you know, it's actually, it's a chain. It's based in Arkansas, but they've also got locations in Oklahoma, and I think there may be some up in Missouri as well. So they're, you know, a number of them in Arkansas and then Missouri and in Oklahoma. You know, with branches, but they have people, you know, so you walk in there and you've actually got people. Now, sort of what you're describing, I guess they must be terrified of, perhaps of being robbed. And so you're sort of kind of walking up and you're not really dealing directly with them. Maybe your bank, whatever bank you bank with, has been robbed a lot. And so this sort of precludes that because it sort of eliminates, you know, you walk in there and you're just dealing with the person through a screen and a camera and maybe a drawer that kind of, you know, moves back and forth so they can give you their money or, you know, your money and so on and so forth, or you can make your deposit or whatever. So, you know, I don't know. It kind of depends on what you want as a customer. I don't think that every bank is going to do that. Some banks will do that, and it kind of depends on what their customers want, their particular customers want. And whether they are willing to put up with that, you know, do you need to have, do you find that valuable to go in and actually interact with your banker directly behind the counter, and you know, you're making direct eye contact and so on and so forth? Is that, how important is that? And that would depend on, you know, the local, sort of your local culture. So here, I don't think anything like that would really fly. you know, this part of the country. I don't know that that would really work very well. But maybe, you know, in a more densely populated area, I would think that, you know, especially if they've been robbed quite very much, and this is, you know, like in a city, for example, that might be, you know, people would maybe be more willing to kind of do their banking that way. Now, I don't make many trips to the bank, but, you know, I'm happy with my bank. Everything kind of happens mostly online anymore. Once in a great while, I'll go to one of the ATMs and get money out of the ATM, and then even more rarely, I'll end up having to make a trip to the bank. Maybe I go to the bank like once every 3 to 4 months, even though the bank is there. I just don't have any reason to go in there. So, and, you know, and personally, because kind of everything is happening online, so on and so forth. But, I don't know, that, I guess, you know, if you get used to that, if that's how the bank is doing, and you're just sort of used to it, and you just... Because it's kind of like you're going through the drive-thru, because that's basically, you know, you go through the drive-thru and you press the button, or you put whatever it is in the thing, and or they'll come on there, you know, when it's your turn, they'll come on and ask, you know, say hi to you and ask you what you need, and you're sort of dealing with them through the pneumatic tube, you know, that you send the thing in and then they send whatever back out. Or they've got the drawer. If you're right next to the building, they've got the drawer that comes out. So, I don't know. That's interesting. I've never seen a bank. I don't think any of the banks around here do that. Now, I might be wrong, you know, depending on, you know, because we have some of the big national chains here as well. And so maybe some of it's possible some of them are doing their banking that way. I really don't see that working too well here, but you never know. It might.
And they press a button and the money comes spitting out at you. It's almost like an ATM, but there's a person behind it. At least there is now. And then there's some banks that charge money when you want to see a person.
Now, I had this interesting thought while you were describing that. What's to say that the person that you're talking to, are they really there? Are they really in that building? Or are they in some central building? Let's say there's a central location. It could be downtown. It could be in a different state, different city. Or it could be in India. Ever think of that? You know, you're pressing the button and they come on and... you know, and the person's actually in, you know, they could be in a completely different country. You know, and you're sort of telling them what you want and so on and so forth. And then they, you know, they sort of initiate it. So, that, you know, and I could see where that could actually happen. You know, technologically, it could really be made to work. It could be made workable, I think, a situation like that. Now, in your case, there's about a 99% chance that the person is actually right there. You know, if you're sending it, you know, like you've endorsed a check and you've given it to them, that person is actually there dealing with it. So, but I don't know. It does become possible to... You know, like you could do complete, there are, you know, and there have been for several years, there are banks that are strictly online. They have no locations. They're just online only. And so in those cases, you don't go to a building. You know, what's the point of, there is no building. They're just, they just exist online. Is a maybe someone has an office somewhere and a series of servers, and those banks are just completely online. And those banks do exist, and I don't know much about them. I've never done any research on them, but in some cases they actually do pay better interest rates. You know, the difference is that it's online only. You know, so what is the benefit of having a local location?
Then at Walmart and other stores like it, you have the self-scan checkouts. Where I worked at Meijer over 20 years ago now, there was, you know, 36 rows of cashiers. And when we were busy, we'd have all 36 populated. And now a good chunk of those are replaced by self-service. For, you know, there's a self-service for even for big orders. You know, like if you have a whole cart load, you can run it all yourself.
Okay, now the self-service, they have those, and I've used them before, and they've, you know, like the Walmart store, the Walmart stores around Northwest Arkansas, of course, Walmart, you know, their home office is based in Bentonville, so it's actually been quite a few years ago they started experimenting locally, because they use these stores around here to experiment with. They started experimenting locally with self-checkout. And the store that I go to most of the time, it's a pretty good sized store. One of the stores, there's two stores in Fayetteville, Arkansas. And so I go to this one because it's about, you know, it takes me about 12 minutes to get there, so it's not that far away. It, you know, they've recently expanded the number of self-checkout. You know, they've expanded that area, and they still have some people in there if you want to go through the line. But I don't know, for some reason, it's been a long time since I've actually used the self-checkout. I don't know why. I just kind of... You know, I don't have any problem with technology, and I've used the self-checkout before. And actually, it can be more convenient because you can, you know, kind of get through it quicker. But for some reason, I there's this tendency I have to gravitate towards, finding a line with an actual checker in it. You know, and of course, they have, you know, sometimes you end up waiting a little while, depending on how busy the store is. So... I don't know. I think it's kind of depends on what kind of habit you get into. You know, because eventually, you know, if you get into the habit of just using the self-checkout because, you see, well, hey, I can actually get out of here quicker. You use the self-checkout to get into that habit, then, it's not a big deal. Versus standing there, you know, kind of waiting in line, and it seems like, you know, you always pick the wrong one because, you know, they need a price or something goes wrong or what have you, and, you know, they've got to call a supervisor over. You know, it seems like that, you know, it doesn't always happen, but it seems like, you know, you've had that experience. I think virtually everyone that's ever shopped in a store like that, whether it's a supermarket or a department store like Walmart or whatever, you've had that experience, you know, where, oops, I picked the wrong one.
So what I think is happening now is a self-service revolution. And unfortunately, for those who don't want to go to college or don't want to learn, they aren't going to have jobs. Or if they have a job, it might even pay less than they already do now. You know? Restaurants could replace servers with robots, and robots...
Well, now again, the idea that you're going to... That might work in McDonald's. Maybe it would, maybe it wouldn't. But, you know, at that point, if it's just, if it's entirely a machine you're dealing with, you're talking about a giant vending machine. So let's say you go into a restaurant, you know, if I go into a restaurant, you know, depending, you know, let's say I'm kind of trapped somewhere and there's a vending, you know, they've got vending machines, you know, these like a break room with lots of vending machines, you know, so you have even frozen stuff in the vending machine. And so, you know, I'll do that if I have to, you know, and of course they always have microwave ovens. I'll do that if I have to. And I do end up going to McDonald's quite a bit, you know, a place like McDonald's or wherever else. You know, if you got somebody, you know, of course, you know, their ingredients, the fast food ingredients are obviously not the most select. They're not the greatest in the world, but you go to Taco Bell and you've actually got somebody back there, putting the ingredients together, sort of manufacturing your order, your sandwiches. Same way with McDonald's and so on and so forth. So if it's going to be, you know, if it's going to be completely automated, then it might as well just be a vending machine. And so I don't know how that would fly. Because a vending machine sandwich just isn't even the same thing as Taco Bell, or it isn't even as bad as we think McDonald's and Taco Bell and Burger King and all those others, Subway, as bad as I think those are, or undesirable sometimes as I think those are, they're far more desirable than eating out of a vending machine. So I don't know. And then if I go into a restaurant, especially let's say I go into a, you know, like one of the restaurants in town here that I've like to frequent, you know, a robot coming up and, you know, asking me what I want for my drinks, or maybe, you know, they got some kind of iPad or touchpad, you know, that you enter what you want and then the thing comes up and gives it to you. I just don't see that working very well. You know, in some cases it might. It just depends on what your expectations are. Again, sometimes I'll eat out of vending machines, or I will eat out of McDonald's or Burger King or Taco Bell or so on and so forth. I will eat out at Wendy's. I will eat out of those places. I have to. But at the same time, you know, if I go to a different type of restaurant, I'm looking for a different kind of an experience. And I just don't see that, you know, that kind of an experience being provided by a robot. So again, you know, it sounds like, well, you know, in one case you could say, well, it sort of sounds like these people could all be replaced with automation. But then again, it depends on the value. The automation, I think what I'm saying really is that the value that automation can provide is not necessarily something that we, you know, that is going to be the same as that being provided by, you know, a human being. You know, and I can give you, you know, let's say you pick a restaurant like Red Lobster or Olive Garden, you know, one of that, you know, that's not really super high-end restaurant. That's just, you know, those are just, they're decent restaurants, you know, big chains. So you pick a restaurant like that, a person, you know, a waiter or a waitress working in a place like that, if they're really good and they really hustle, they can make a pretty good living. So that tells me that they're providing a value. And I don't think that could really be automated. So there's some things that can't be automated. So that there are some functions that a human being is going to inherently be able to provide value doing whatever service. Now, some services obviously can be, you know, can be replaced. I mean, just think of, you know, production lines. You know, there are tons of things that, you know, tedious things that they, you know, used to have people do, that machines can do it. The machines do it better, and it frees people up from, you know, tedious repetition. And then the other thing with automation is that it actually, the more stuff that can be automated, the more you can increase the productivity of one worker, the better. The better off we all are. It helps to raise our living standards. You know, now I know some people have this idea that it's just a fixed system and there's only so many jobs, and if you automate all these things, it's going to take it away and so on and so forth. And that's you can't look at it like that, because that's a flawed way, that's a sort of a myopic way of looking. What you want are people that are able to produce as much as possible. You know, so if we got people that, don't want to, you know, I don't believe that everyone has to be educated in college, for example. Everyone doesn't need a specialized college education. I think that works fine for some people, and for others, don't need that. Now, I think where we've gotten into big trouble is that, you know, the overall education system is not really educating. That's really not its focus, despite what they say. You know, I've talked about this ad infinitum. What's going on with our education system in the United States of America is that it is a system that is systematically destroying, corrupting the children away from their common sense. And so now we have, you know, we've got millions and millions of college graduates that can't get jobs, you know, let alone the, you know, the people that are working in McDonald's or whatever. You know, we've got, you know, because they've been completely maleducated, miseducated, separated from their common sense, you know, and it's, you go into a line of work that you have no interest in, or you try to educate yourself on, you know, something you have no interest in, you're wasting your time. We all know people that have gone for, some kind of education where they've studied something, or some kind of a job or something, they've studied to be something, maybe a teacher or something, and they find out they just can't do it, that they have no interest in it. And they end up doing something completely unrelated. So I think as long as you are able to provide value, you know, and it may be difficult for some people to realize what value is, what the value of doing something is, you know, what the value of different types of jobs are. But as long as you can do that, you know, that is what it's sort of an additive effect. You've got people that are working and building and actually doing things that are of value. And then, but of course, we all end up consuming. So you're either, you know, you've got a number of people that are, you know, kind of adding, if you think of it in terms of a pile, we're really adding to the pile, you know, but we're all consuming from the same pile. So sort of adding into the pot, and then it sort of all gets stirred up, and then we all consume from the same pot. And so as more and more people are sort of dysfunctionalized and don't really contribute, we have fewer and fewer people that are actually producing anything of real value. And government does not produce any of it. I'm sorry, but it doesn't. Some of the functions of government are necessary. It's necessary to, you know, keep the streets clean and have a, you know, defense and so on and so forth. Those things are necessary, but they don't contribute to the overall pot in real terms. And then this idea that we're just going to, you know, pay more or whatever. We're going to mandate that we pay more and so on and so forth. And we're going to make monopolies and, you know, so that we can't send jobs elsewhere and all that. And we're just going to, we're somehow going to tweak the system of, you know, of exchange, which that's all money really is. You're just exchanging value. It's just a, you know, and you think, well, we'll just tweak that around and everybody's going to have more. Well, it doesn't work that way because you've got people that are contributing to the pile or contributing to the pot. And so the bigger the pot is, in real world terms, people that are actually doing valuable things that have real world value, you know, and that spans a broad, very broad collection of, you know, different things, that possible things that people do. As long as that, if you can get that bigger and bigger, we all have better lifestyles. Everyone benefits. So, you know, and it's not hard to, I know people get all mixed up and you know, part of the problem is they think they know things, quote unquote, because they you know, they're emotionalized into knowing it. You know, and you know, you make a challenge to people, and then that's the first thing that they'll do. You know, if you try to get them to become objective, and the first thing they do is become emotional. And they'll say, well, you know, and they can get really vehement. Knowing things, you know, that, well, this is such and such, you know, and it's, but they know it, quote unquote, know it because, you know, somehow they think that, you know, there's emotion attached to it. And so therefore, you know, someone, quote unquote, knows something through, you know, some sort of an emotional reaction, then it really disables their ability to be objective. It disables their ability to, therefore, to think. So, anyway, let's go ahead and listen to the rest of Joel's file here.
Could probably keep people happier than some people would. So, while I am all for trying to figure out technological solutions for things, you know, some of it just makes me wonder what's going to happen to people that don't want to go get a college education. Or don't want to even do any learning after they go through K-12. So I think this country is in for a rude awakening. You know, they think that.
Well, let me interrupt. Again, you know, we're talking about you know, technology and automation and so on and so forth. Our problem, you know, I'm going to go right back to the thing. Our problem is morals. Our morals are gone as a nation. that is the problem, you know. We tend to want to focus on these other things, and we got to fix this problem, and you know, figure out a way of fixing this problem, figure out a way of fixing that problem. And the real problem, the root of the problem, is morals. That's why I can't listen to Rush Limbaugh anymore. Even though I like Rush Limbaugh, I can't listen to him anymore. Because he's not dealing with the real problem. The real root of the problem is our morals. Our moral structure is, you know, with at least half of the people, is gone. And it's in serious jeopardy with the other half. So we focus on the wrong things. It's our morals that are really at the root of all of our problems. You know, and unless and until we can fix that, these other problems are just going to get worse and worse and worse. And, you know, at some point, you know, we could end up, depending on how far it progresses, if we don't blow ourselves to smithereens first, we'll end up back in caves.
That workers wanting, you know, I'm thinking that, you know, McDonald's could say, okay, sure, we'll pay you $15 an hour. And then they'll have to remove the physical worker from making their product. You know, then you have two managers running a whole store, you know, and part of their job would be just to fix the system when it breaks down. The actual serving of food won't happen. So that's a thought.
All right. Well, thank you, Joel. Yeah. So it's, I don't know. See, you have the problem, you know, again, going back to the McDonald's thing. You have the problem, well, how would you automate all, you know, because the typical McDonald's has got how many people back in there working? You know, maybe 10 people, depending. You know, so you got people making sandwiches and so on and so forth. Now, all of that could be automated. I don't know how much the machine would cost. You know, and how would you be able to make that machine reliable? It would obviously be fairly expensive. How would you make it worthwhile? Let's say that you would have, you'd still have people up in the front. You know, there's different ways of sort of imagining it, but you know, you'd still, I think you would still want people up in the front taking the orders. And then the machine could manufacture, you know, it could take the patty, because the patties are all kind of pre-manufactured, you know, they're already pre-manufactured. And so it could, you know, you could cook the, you know, an automated process could cook them perfectly. Now, of course, you know, you'd have a machine, so the machine, you know, you'd be putting food through it. It would have to be cleaned. That would be a serious issue. It would have to be kept very clean. So, you know, so something could, you know, cook the fries and do all of those things. Now, if you had all that stuff pre-manufactured and then just shipped to the McDonald's, and then it would be like a giant vending machine, that, you know, even that, you know, the vending machine food is not as good as McDonald's is. I'm sorry, you know, as bad as the we think that the McDonald's food is, or the Taco Bell food is, or the Burger King food is, or even the Wendy's food is, or the, you know, so on and so forth, Arby's. As bad as I think, you know, as we think that is sometimes, it's 1,000 times better than a vending machine food. Pre-manufactured sandwich. So, I think automation could kind of take over in some instances. You know, maybe they could make that work. You know, depending on, you know, again, depending on how how expensive the machine would be, and then, but you know, you would still have the issue that the thing would have to be kept clean. That would mean someone would have to clean it, unless you could sort of automate that as well. But you'd still have to inspect it, and machines break down. So, I don't know. See, you have the theory, you know, oh, this stuff can all be automated. Well, you know, it can, but is it practical in the real world? And will real people, you know, real customers deal with the, how do you deal with the automation? Of what value is it for me as a customer to deal with automation? Is it going to compromise the quality of the food? Or is it going to compromise the quality of the service? There has to be, you know, you have to take these trade-offs into account. And so as a customer, most of the time, I want to deal with people. If I'm getting food in any kind of a restaurant, whether it's a McDonald's or whatever, I want to deal with people, you know, and I will deal with vending machines if I have to. If that's the only choice, I'll deal with it. I will do it. If it's regular food, I want real people involved because it's going to up the quality. So, but I don't know. Our real problem is morals. And it always has been and it always will be. You know, and so we have this idea that we can have our rotten morals and just do whatever we want, you know, sleep around and have broken families and so on and so forth, and still have a wonderful life, peaceful and strife-free, and we can't. I'm sorry, but you can't. Those morals are absolutely important. And if you lose them, you end up with hell on earth. Deservedly so. So, anyhow, I think I'm going to go ahead and cut this off. Hope everyone has had a great Christmas day. Hope you have a great rest of the week. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.